So you may have heard the story about the man who was known to be a chronic worrier. I mean, this man, his name was Joe, this man worried about everything and anything. But one day, one of Joe's good friends spotted him on the street, and Joe was sauntering along, looking peaceful, like he didn't have a care in the world. So the friend said to him, "Well, Joe, what happened? You don't look worried anymore." And Joe said, "No, I'm not." And the man said, "Well, share with me, what happened? What happened?" And Joe said, "Oh, I figured out how to solve this. I have somebody else do my worry for me." And the man said, "Well, how in the world does that work?" And Joe said, "Well, I have to pay him quite a bit. I have to pay him, actually, $2,000 a week." And the friend said, "Oh, my gosh, Joe, can you afford that?" And he said, "No, I really can't, but that's his worry." So I'm going to ask you to do something here this morning. And that is, if you're willing, I'd like for you to share with us your propensity about worrying. Let's say that one is hardly at all, as you hold up your hand, and five is a lot of the time. And remember, this is a safe, loving, spiritual community. The doors are closed, and the video equipment is not on, so we're okay. All right, so ready? One, two, three, your propensity to worry. Okay, I see actually everything from ones to fives, and thank you for being honest about that. Let me ask another question. You guys want to share that, Ponzers? Oh, this is an interesting. Yeah, I'm not going to go there with any judgment, but Tony has a one and Betty has a five. What does that say? I'm not getting into that. Okay. Actually, I have another question for you. How many of you feel that you worry less today than you used to? Anybody? I certainly do. Well, research actually shows that that's one of the advantages of aging, that as we age, we do tend to worry less, okay? Honestly, that's true for me. A few years ago, I would have been a solid five. I mean to tell you, and I hate in a way telling this story because it just reinforces that idea that, you know, mothers are always the cause of all evil, and I don't like to reinforce that, but my mother was an absolute master in the art of worry. I am not kidding you. She had it down. And one worry ritual that I will never forget, it still haunts me, is if my father was supposed to get home from work at 5:30, and if he was not walking in the door at exactly 5:30, she would go to the front window, wringing her hands, scanning the street for his car, and if he was not home by 5:35. Some of you are shaking your heads. Were you with me? If he was not home by 5:35, she would say to my brother and me, "What is the matter with you two? How can you be sitting there watching television when your father is probably wrapped around a tree or on his way to the hospital?" Well, it's funny now. It wasn't so funny then. It really, I have to say, took me a long time, many years of concerted effort to try to just break out of that culture of worry in which I was raised. Luckily, I had a father who didn't worry much at all, so I think he was my balance. But in the Sermon on the Mount, which we've been looking at the past few weeks, Jesus has lots to say about the subject of worry. Now, many times, as we've been talking about these series of lessons, we've compared his teachings on the mountaintop overlooking the Sea of Galilee to the old law handed down to Moses on Mount Sinai. And Jesus makes it clear that his new teachings were designed to shift our understanding from fearfully obeying arbitrary laws from on high to joyfully cooperating with the divine as loving and creative law. And so Jesus is going to address this theory of worry. Our main sources are the ones they've been all along, The Secret According to Jesus, and notice the subtitle of Ed Townley's book, Living a Joyful Life, and The Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. So Jesus continues his lessons by saying to his disciples, "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes. Jesus' teachings about worry are plainly and masterfully linked to the teaching we looked at last week about the impossibility of serving two masters. Remember that one if you were with us? Jesus is telling us emphatically here that we have to choose between the master of worry and fear, or we choose the master of truth and faith in the divine. The choice is up to us. There simply is not room enough in your mind for both worry and faith. You must decide which one gets to live there. Choose this day whom you will serve. When Jesus says, "Isn't life more than food?" he's talking about the inner life of awareness and right thinking. When we live from the consciousness of our divine identity, really there's no reason for us to be anxious. Jesus' directive is very clear: don't worry. So he continues, "Look at the birds of the air. They do not plant or harvest or store food in barns, for your heavenly Father feeds them. Aren't you far more valuable than they?" Now, winters were harsh, of course, for birds and creatures in the air. But his point here is that birds of the air don't plant crops. They don't store grain in barns or silos. They don't shop at supermarkets or have pantries or freezers. They don't even have the food network to figure out how to prepare their food, right? Each new day, they just follow their instincts to find food, and it never occurs to them that food might not be there. As I said, winters can be harsh, food and water might be scarce, but birds fulfill their nature and accept their roles in the circle of life. Reverend Ed Bayman invites us to imagine a scene in a nest in a tree where Mama Bird asks Papa Bird, "What's wrong, Papa? Why aren't you sleeping?" And Papa says, "I can't sleep at all. I'm so worried. What if we don't have worms tomorrow for our three new chicks?" Probably not what happens in bird communication, right? Instead, birds simply greet the day singing and doing what is necessary to survive, and doing it joyfully, it seems like. Metaphysically, birds represent high thoughts in consciousness. Jesus is telling the disciples that just to keep in their minds that the perfect divine plan is one of supply and substance. Divine energy cares for the birds. We are made in the image and likeness of spirit. Surely the same is true for us. Now, seemingly, I'm not 100% sure about this, but seemingly, we're the only creatures who dwell in worry that our supplies might be limited. Ed Townley says, "Jesus is suggesting here that logic alone should help us see the fallacy in this kind of thinking. We, like the birds of the air, are precious and important to all that is, to our divine. Can we really believe that the divine is at work in all creation except us? That's not very logical, is it? We still have our work to do, of course, as we co-create with this magnificent power we call God, just as the birds have to search for food. But like the birds of the air, we are part of the eternal cycle of life, always one in spirit's love and abundance. So Jesus is saying, what is there to worry about and fear? Next, Jesus says, "And can all your worries add a single moment to your span of life?" We have to remember that in Jesus' day, the world was stable and unpredictable. And we think that's a modern condition, right? The disciples and most of Jesus' followers lived in a world where one summer's drought could wipe out crops for the entire winter, and one night's unsuccessful fishing meant there was no food on the table the next day. Yet Jesus is telling his disciples that worry is futile. It cannot add even a moment to our lives, and in fact, in reality, it often detracts and diminishes the moments we have. Worry has been called a thief. It robs us of our joy and steals the time that we might be concentrating on our ever-unfolding good. Really, when you think about our 12 powers, worry is a misuse of our power of imagination. Instead of visualizing the best possible outcomes, when we worry, we imagine ever-unfolding gloom and doom, don't we? That's what our heads are around. And it has been said, worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrow, it empties today of its strength. I think my mother believed, and many people believe, that if we put enough energy into worrying, we can prevent something unpleasant from happening. But that just simply doesn't work. William James said, I love this quote, "If you believe that feeling bad or worrying long enough will change a past or future event, then you are residing on another planet with a different reality system." Just doesn't work. And another great philosopher, one of my favorites, Charles Schultz said, "Worrying won't stop the bad stuff from happening, it just stops you from enjoying the good." And that is absolutely true. Jesus is telling all of us that our worrying doesn't change a thing. It only makes things worse. Because we know that energy flows where our attention goes, right? The negative energy of worry can actually draw us to negative outcomes that we fear. And it certainly can wreck our health in the process. The Harvard Health Review very recently reported that persisting anxiety, anxiety that you keep with you over and over for a long time, has been implicated in multiple chronic illnesses, including heart disease, high blood pressure, asthma, COPD, and gastrointestinal conditions. All those with chronic anxiety have more severe symptoms and actually have a greater risk of death, according to Harvard Medical School. So Jesus goes on, and he says, "And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith?" Jesus is telling his beloved disciples and us that we are never separate from the omnipresent power of God, except in our own consciousness. If we focus all our energy on survival and comfort, we'll never be free to explore and express our greater spiritual purpose. Like the lilies of the field, we are already perfect, whole, and complete, and we have not even begun to realize our indwelling beauty. We do not need to struggle to become. We need to awaken to what we really are. The lilies neither toil nor spin, says Jesus, but only grow and reveal their magnificence. Now, to understand his comments about the grass, we need to know that the Greek word for grass was shortened, a general term meaning grass, herbs, grain, and hay. And on the hillsides of Palestine, grass and even sometimes flowers, if they were desperate, would be grown one day, and because of the scarcity of wood, they would be pulled up the next day to be dried and used as fuel to keep their ovens going for food, you know, to cook the food. Here today, gone tomorrow. But still, perfect, omnipresent divine energy clothes, protects, expresses in the grass as it does in all creation. No worries necessary. Jesus invites us to consider this ending with the penetrating words, "You of little faith." Anybody ever heard those before? Can you think of where they're used? Anybody? Any incident where Jesus says that? Somebody's doing a great job up here, I'll tell you that. I don't know who it is. Well, let me give you a little clue. But the two that I'm going to talk about, there were more. Two that I'm going to talk about happened on the same Sea of Galilee where they are at the moment looking over. And there they are. And it was actually, remember this one? when a storm arose on the sea, and Jesus was having a little well-deserved nap in the back of the boat, and the disciples got so frightened that they woke him up. And when he woke up, he said to them, "You of little faith, why are you afraid?" And then he calms the sea and the waves by saying, what? "Peace be still. Peace be still." And later on that same sea, Peter takes a few steps walking on water like Jesus, but then he falters and begins to sink, and Jesus says to him, "You of little doubt, you of little faith, why do you doubt?" So this is kind of a pattern with Jesus talking to the disciples. And really, you know, we know that those disciples did not completely lack faith. They were Jesus' chosen few, weren't they? He chose them to follow him, to carry on in his footsteps when he was no longer here on this earth. But like us, even though they had faith, sometimes they lost their courage and they lost their faith temporarily. So Jesus continues, "So do not worry, saying, 'What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?' For after all these things the Gentiles seek." Some of the translations I like better say the Gentiles run around looking for all these things. "For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things." Now remember, the Gentile term, we talked about this a few weeks ago, doesn't mean the same thing it means today. The word Gentile simply meant those who are unaware of a spiritual dimension of life, those that think the outer world is all there is. So Jesus is saying those without spiritual awareness pursue only the things of this world. And as spiritual beings having a human experience, we have to re-examine and just release some of those old beliefs. Beliefs like life is a constant struggle. You know, you can't win. We hear them all the time. Society feeds these to us all the time. We're powerless and separate. Our needs define us. I mean, those are some of the beliefs that we just have to let go of in order to live in this spiritual consciousness. And in this context, in which Jesus gives what I personally believe to be one of his most profound teachings, he looks into the eyes of those disciples whom he has chosen. Those men who have left their wives, their children, and their homes to follow him. And he says to them, "But first seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things, everything you need, will be added to you." This, to me, is the very heart of Jesus' message throughout his entire ministry. And Townley says, seeking the kingdom means that our purpose as spiritual beings sharing together in this human experience is to create, choice by choice, thought by thought, the higher spiritual consciousness that Jesus calls the kingdom of heaven. Human needs and challenges are worldly and secondary, and as long as we focus on achieving our spiritual purpose, our human needs will be abundantly met. Often we think that we must solve all of our human issues first in order to have time and space to deal with the spiritual, don't we? I mean, there's not enough time to pray. There's not enough time to meditate. We don't have time to come to services. But really, this mindset just causes us to live from the energy of fear and anxiety. In fact, it's only by committing to the spiritual, making choices in our lives out of love, that we can fully embrace and enjoy our human experience. But Jesus teaches us that we do not use spiritual awareness to solve our problems. Instead, we surrender to the awareness of the Christ within, and our problems dissolve like the illusions they have always been. This is the simple secret of a well-lived life. When we lovingly release just thoughts of lack and limitation, we awaken to the joyful, limitless love of the divine in us, around us, and through us. And here's the good news. The good news is we don't have to give up worldly pleasures. Jesus never asked us to do that. It absolutely says, seek first the kingdom and all these things will be provided for you, all that you need and want. It only asks us to keep our priorities straight and focus first on the presence of power of God, and then the blessings truly do flow. Finally, Jesus says, "Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself." I'm sure of Jesus' humor in the day. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Now, we talked a few weeks ago about living in the now moment. I think we hooked that to the lesson where Jesus tells us to make no future oaths. Remember that if you were here? The Buddha said, "The secret of health for both mind and body is not to mourn for the past, not to worry about the future, nor to anticipate troubles, but to live in the present moment wisely and earnestly." And I might also add, joyously. To live in the present moment joyously. The past and future are both really illusions. Worry about the past is often focused on regret and guilt. And really, it doesn't change a thing. We just keep playing those old tapes over and over again in our heads. And worrying about the future is fear about something that might never happen. Remember, Mark Twain said, "I've had a lot of worries in my life, most of which never happened." Right? There was a man who didn't quite get this the way Mark Twain intended it. He is lying on his therapist's couch and he says to his doctor, "I don't care what they say. Worrying works for me. 99% of the things I worry about never happen." The thing is, worrying can be a deeply embedded habit. This teaching of Jesus has been called one of the most quoted and one of the least lived. And the reason is, it's not easy. We are in our human skins. We face challenges every day. But maybe one of the most important things we can do to help break this habit of worry is simply to find the right perspective. Here are some statistics that might kind of help us do that. And there are many different statistics about this. I chose one that was kind of middle of the road. This one says 40% of the things we worry about never come to pass. Some research studies say 90% of the things we worry about never come to pass. It depends on how you count them. 30% of all of our worries involve the past and can't be changed. We just talked about that. 12% of all our worries are about health concerns, and we've already said it makes our health worse, doesn't it? And 10% of our worries are petty and not even remembered. Some of the people in the studies did not remember 3 months out what they'd been worrying about. That was how inconsequential it was. And yet, you know, they put themselves in peril by that kind of worry. So if you do the math, that means 92% of the things people worry about have no or little substance. 8% of what we worry about, fewer than one worry in 10, might be a real concern. So we might ask ourselves this: how many of the things on our worry list of the past have come to fruition? Can you think of things you've worried about that never ever materialized? And if they did materialize, were they as bad as you imagined, or did you find the strength to endure them? That's the point. If we have trouble discerning whether worry is legitimate or not, and sometimes we do, we could share with a trusted friend, mentor, or counselor, someone who will listen without judgment. Sometimes just naming our worry out loud diffuses it. That's a Buddhist technique. You know, you start worrying, you say to yourself, "Oh, this is just worry." You just label it and go on. And if we decide something legitimate is bothering us, we might ask ourselves, how are we feeling about the situation? Am I telling myself, that this is an impossible challenge, that I can't face it? Am I letting myself believe that I am incapable of this? All those mental models about ourselves. Reverend Michael Bernard Beckwith says, "Regardless of what might happen in your life, the moment you begin to think properly," that's what all the Sermon on the Mount is pretty much about, thinking properly, "you will find there's a power within you that's greater than the world. It will begin to emerge. It will take over your life." Now, does this not sound like the Sermon on the Mount? It will feed you. It will clothe you. It will guide you, protect you, direct you, sustain your very existence if you let it. "This is what I know for sure," Dr. Beckwith says. So in these teachings, Jesus' words, "Take no anxious thought are repeated no less than 5 times in a fairly short span. This is practical Christianity at its best, teaching us that every moment of our lives is filled with spiritual possibility. Centered in our hearts in oneness with God, we have all the power, love, faith, and strength that we need to live abundantly and joyously. No worries. And so it is. So let's take a moment now just to close our eyes and just affirm the great truth that we know about our God. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this affirmation is printed in your bulletin. There is only one presence and one power at work in the universe and my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.